headlines, at least four people are killed in an explosion in the Afghan capital, Kabul. The unrest in South Africa, which was triggered by the jailing of former President Jacob Zuma, intensifies despite the deployments of thousands of soldiers. Families of some victims of a hospital fire in Iraq hold funerals for their loved ones as the death toll rose to 92. From our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gizumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. An explosion in the Afghan capital, Kabul, has killed at least four civilians and wounded five others. Earlier, our correspondent, Amin Alemi, gave us an update on the situation.
According to Firdaus Faramaz, the spokesperson of Kabul Police Headquarters, the incident took place after this roadside bomb blast went up very close to a traffic police checkpost in Sinamaya Pamir area of Maiwand Road. The current situation proves that not only the most secure areas in Afghanistan are facing widespread violence and fightings between Afghan security forces and the Taliban, but also the militants have taken control over some key border areas that connect Afghanistan to northern and western neighbors of Afghanistan, including Tajikistan and Iran.
The UN Refugee Agency has warned that Afghanistan is on the brink of a humanitarian crisis as fighting escalates between government forces and the Taliban militant group.
Afghanistan is on the brink of another humanitarian crisis. This can be avoided. This should be avoided. So efforts to secure peace has to be strengthened and doubled. And this is what Afghans expect.
The spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees said an estimated 270,000 more Afghans have been displaced since January this year. He urged the international community to step in and support the government and the people of Afghanistan. According to a UN report, some 3.5 million people have been internally displaced over the past two decades. The report also shows that the number of civilian casualties has risen around 30% since the start of this year's compared to 2020. Afghanistan is witnessing a surge in violence in the recent weeks as Taliban militants are pushing to gain more territory. Now, Russia has warned the U.S. against redeploying its military forces from Afghanistan to neighboring Central Asian countries. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov said in this move of a permanent U.S. military presence is unacceptable. He warned that such a scenario would greatly change not only Moscow's perception of regional developments, but also its relations with the U.S. Rybakov added that Russia had made its position perfectly clear to the Americans. Russia's foreign minister had also earlier stressed that the U.S. presence in Central Asian countries would not address regional security concerns. Sergei Lavrov said no regional country had allowed the deployment of U.S. forces pulled out of Afghanistan. Last month, President Joe Biden said after its withdrawal from Afghanistan, the U.S. would reorganize its, quote, counterterrorism capabilities and assets in the region. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has slammed the U.S.'s unilateralism and bullying. Zarif said multilateralism has been weakened and Washington's policies undermine international laws as well as peace and stability in the world. He was speaking at a meeting of the non-aligned movement, called on the alliance to unite against this phenomenon. Regarding the 2015 nuclear deal, Zarif said that the Islamic Republic has always been committed to diplomacy and talks to resolve disputes. He said Iran's participation in talks for reviving the agreement is a manifestation of the same diplomacy, despite Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the deal and the new administration's insistence on continuing its predecessor's failed policies towards Tehran. Also, Iran has sent condolences to the families of the victims of a hospital fire in the southern Iraqi city of Nasiriyah. In a statement, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh also wished speedy recovery for those who sustained injuries, expressing Iran's readiness to provide medical aid for Iraq. At least 92 people were killed and over 100 others injured after the fire engulfed a COVID-19 isolation ward in Al Hussein Hospital on Monday night. The cause of the fire is yet to be stated. Meanwhile, some funerals have been held in the holy city of Najaf for the victims. This is the second hospital blaze in Iraq this year. In April, a fire sparked by the explosion of oxygen cylinders at a hospital in Baghdad killed 82 and injured 110 others. The Yemeni Armed Forces has announced a successful operation against Saudi-backed Takfiri terrorists in the country's central province of Al-Baida. The army spokesman said the operation was carried out in response to attacks by Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists backed by Saudi-led coalition. Brigadier General Yahya Sari said the military managed to fully retake large swaths of territory and seize huge caches of weapons and ammunition. He said hundreds of terrorists were also killed or injured. Sari said that the Saudi-led coalition conducted dozens of airstrikes in support of the terrorists. He vowed that the Yemeni armed forces would continue their operation until the end of the Saudi-led war and blockade and the liberation of all territories from the grip of terrorists and aggressors. And now it is time for this edition of the News Review. Now, the death toll from days of violence in South Africa sparked by the jailing of former President Jacob Zuma has risen to 45. The Prime Minister of Gauteng Province said 10 bodies were found on Monday at a looted shopping center near Johannesburg. They were killed during the stampede. Earlier, the Prime Minister of the southern province of KwaZulu-Natal also reported the death of 26 people there during a stampede. Authorities have stepped up security to quell the unrest. Nearly 760 people have so far been arrested. On Monday, the Constitutional Court heard an application to review its decision on jailing Zuma for contempt of court. The court has reversed this judgment to a later but unspecified date. Zuma is sentenced to 15 months in jail for not appearing before a commission looking into graft scandals during his presidency. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Mr. Ralph Mateka, author and political analyst, joining us live from Johannesburg, and also Mr. Julius Mabluto, political analyst, joining us live from London. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with our guest from Johannesburg. If you could please give us some first-hand information of what exactly is happening. And to us, looking at this whole situation from the outside, the biggest question mark is all of this chaos only for 15 months in jail, or is there something behind it?
What triggered the protest is, of course, the incarceration of Mr. Zuma after he refused to appear before a commission of inquiry into corruption. And indeed, it is a very interesting question that will South Africans actually go all the way for just a 15-month incarceration, but also most importantly, all that we have seen so far, the greatest mayhem I've ever seen in post-apartheid South Africa as a researcher here, is it just for one man? The reality is that it has been triggered by Mr. Zuma's concern and some who support him. However, it is important to note that South Africa has got some socio-economic challenges that actually make it easy for young people to join the looting that we have seen around cities in Johannesburg, around in Durban, which is the port city. So there is no doubt that there is an attempt to politically infiltrate what has been happening on the street, that there are those that actually want to precipitate ungovernability in the society. But all of this is possible because young people are quite desperate. You cannot deny the socioeconomic problems on the ground in South Africa, which is why young people are making themselves available to such kind of activities. I think at this point it has gotten out of control. We have the military being deployed on the ground today as I'm speaking to you. The attempt is to de-escalate the looting, but it continues in various shopping centers in the country as I speak to you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mabluta, from London, our guest there, how serious are these graft allegations against Mr. Zuma?
Well, the former president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, even when he was in power, the charges on corruption were still happening, so they are not very new. And some are concluded, some are not concluded, and he left power with these cases, some of them pending, and therefore continuation of them after he left power was a key thing to do, because the rule of law demands that justice be done, justice be seen to be done. There are cases like when he used, you know, government funds to rebuild his own home where he was staying. There are many several other cases, but the key trigger of this was him being summoned to go to court and refusing to go to court. Therefore, he had to be arrested. There are issues there. You look into the former head of state, probably they could have handled it in a different way. But again, you see, in an African context, some countries, people who believe in the rule of law were celebrating. They were like, let us see an example that him being jailed, that he proves that no one is above the law. So a lot of people in Africa were like, this is the greatest moment for the rule of law, just to see a African head of state being sent to jail for contempt of court was a key thing. Many other countries in Africa, we see some presidents not respecting court orders. They've been given court orders, but they don't hold them. Not even presidents, some leaders disobeying court orders. So the culture of rule of law in Africa is very key, and it needs to be really focused on. Sadly enough, you see people protesting because the president has been sent to jail on the charges of contempt of court. These issues, they are the issue, of course, every president has supporters, and no one wants to see their former head of state, whom they love, being sent to jail, even families. They come from families. No family wants to see their father being sent to jail, especially someone who was in such a dignified place, like being the head of state, being sent to jail. It's different. It's different. So supporters of Zuma are there, and of course they were key drivers of the protest. But also then we need to look into the generation, young people going to protest. And we want to ask ourselves questions. If you support someone to be in contempt of court, supposing that was the case, what kind of a country do you want to live in? A country that not
exactly. That was going to be my next question, since you mentioned the fact that, of course, very rightfully you pointed out that the South African government and judiciary is trying to prove that no one is above the law. And now the supporters of Jacob Zuma, who is, of course, a former leader, he's not even in power anymore, his supporters come out and cause all of these chaos. So does this mean that his supporters want this former leader to be above the law, to be able to not consider and neglect any kind of court order and do whatever he wants? Is that what they're actually defending?
Yeah, I want to go to the issue that former commentator spoke there about. There are social factors, there are other challenges. Probably we may see, away from the supporters of Jacob Zuma, we may see there was a different trigger. This trigger is the pandemic, the lockdown, the youthful people probably who would want any excuse to be out there and about. And maybe there are others who may think looting is a way forward. There are other factors to trigger this just away from the rule of law. Because if actually you are, I'm a young person in any country, I want to live in a country that rule of law is really respected. And there should not be anyone who is above the rule of law. And this in South Africa is key. So therefore, expectation would be don't go to protest because a former head of state has been sent to jail on contempt of court because you want to support the rule of law. But on the other hand, we have to see what are the case, what is the case about? Is it a genuine case? What would be Jacob Zuma's defense? Probably that camp that supports Jacob Zuma, they feel is unfair to him. Then again, you have a different dimension of the case. You have another group who are a group of people who are like Zuma is being persecuted. And now when you put that in proper context and you see the role of Jacob Zuma in freedom fighting as a member of ANC party during the time of Nelson Mandela, then you will be like, you don't put someone who's who really play that role to fight for the freedom of the country in such a disrespectful position as to actually keep him in prison, you know. So there are these things that are in the play into it.
Different factors
but it is
there.
Pretty sad when I look into one president jail, 45 people die. Is it worth it? Is even one life worth losing for that?
Thank you very much, Mr. Ralph Mateka, author and political analyst out of Johannesburg, and Mr. Julius Mapluto, political analyst out of London. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of the News Review.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Joe Biden and the majority of lawmakers in the U.S. don't want to talk about the occupation or the settlements. They want Palestine to remain in the background. We need to push it back to the foreground. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jess Mechanic Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Government Wants Palestine to Fade from View. Don't let it. Stay tuned for more. After this much time, you can predict the mainstream news coverage when it comes to Palestine. The headlines move in well-worn cycles. During periods of overt physical violence in the region, the world pays attention. When the conventional violence recedes, so does that attention. Whenever it feels as though we are inching toward a precipice of some kind, shuffling, however, slowly toward change, the horizon blurs and it all fades from headlines once again. While missiles in flight and buildings collapsing to rubble make for engrossing evening news, the ongoing violence in occupied Palestine is far more quotidian in nature. When the explosions stop, the occupation remains. Recently, the Zionist regime began demolishing Palestinian properties in Silwan, a neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, in order to make space for a religious theme park. The baseline violence of everyday life is a malignant force of oppression that undergirds everything else, but it's not worth prime coverage, apparently, much less outrage. This time around, it felt like there was a shift in the discourse. It felt like the calls for Palestinian liberation were finally expanding beyond activist circles and independent outlets to a broader subset of the American populace. It suddenly felt a bit less fringe and sacrosanct to criticize the Zionist regime. Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights organization, both stated that the Zionist regime is guilty of practicing apartheid. Ali Velshi on MSNBC and John Oliver on HBO, among others, echoed those sentiments. Social media has certainly helped democratize coverage, and the various movements for social and racial justice that have risen to prominence in U.S. appear to have increased our collective awareness around oppression and strengthened withdrawal to fight it. Even though since the ceasefire, which it should be noted, held for less than a month as the Zionist regime launched air raids on Gaza again on June 15th, Palestine has once again faded to the background in mainstream media spaces. And the Biden administration is undoubtedly thrilled about this predictable development because it means they, like their predecessors, can maintain business as usual without having to answer for the inherent brutality of that business. No U.S. president has been particularly tough on the Zionist regime. Then there was Donald Trump, who stated he would be history's most pro-Israel U.S. president. And through a certain lens, he absolutely was. He recognized Al-Quds as the capital of the fake regime of Israel and moved the U.S. embassy there. He pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. He cut aid to Palestine. He helped broker the Abraham Accords. Netanyahu said Trump was the greatest friend that the Zionist regime has ever had in the White House, and he used Trump in campaign posters in 2019. That same year, it's worth noting, research by the Pew Research Center found that out of 33 countries surveyed, the fake regime of Israel was the only regime where a majority, that is 55%, approved of Trump's foreign policies. But regardless of what some U.S. presidents have said, their actions told a different story. The money, the weapons, and the vetoes of U.N. resolutions kept on flowing. In 1981, the United States provided the regime of Israel with just over $2 billion in aid. That total has steadily increased in the subsequent decades and now sits at $3.8 billion, which is part of a decade-long $38 billion deal signed in 2016. It's the largest U.S. military aid deal ever signed. Since 1972, the United States has blocked at least 53 U.N. resolutions against the fake regime of Israel. The U.S. also sells the Zionist regime more weapons than any other nation, accounting for 70.2% of its arms purchases. As buildings were crumbling to dust in Gaza, the Biden administration approved a $735 million arms sales to the Zionist regime. When violence escalated in May, President Biden, the good cop on the Zionist regime during the Obama administration, not only refused to publicly call for a ceasefire himself, but opposed the UN Security Council's attempt to do so. Biden has effusively praised the fake regime of Israel for decades, stating in 1986, were there not an Israel, the United States would have to invade an Israel to protect her interest in the region, unquote. Thus, it is not surprising that during the recent violence, his administration robotically repeated that Israel has a right to defend itself over and over while refusing to comment on whether or not Palestinians had that same right. It appears that, in this administration's eyes, the occupier can defend itself from the occupied, but not the other way around. This rhetoric is nothing new. It has been the default status for U.S. presidents since the occupation began. Israeli settlements in the West Bank, which the United Nations continually stated constitute a flagrant violation of international law, have been growing for over five decades. As the settlements expanded, the military rule that governs the Palestinian neighborhoods situated between and around the Israeli settlements grew all the more draconian and oppressive. Palestinians in the West Bank, including East al-Quds, do not have access to the same water supply, the same roads, the same electrical grids, the same food sources. Since the beginning of the occupation, another clear violation of international law, Order No. 101, has been in effect. The broad rule prohibits Palestinians from any assembly of 10 or more people and might be viewed as political in nature. This includes things like vigils and processions. The rule also prohibits Palestinians from publishing any political material without prior approval from the Zionist regime military. Violating Order No. 101 is punishable with up to 10 years in prison. There are over 592 checkpoints and roadblocks that restrict the movement of Palestinians that the Israeli Jews can pass right by. And due to a devastating blockade, life in Gaza is far worse than life in the West Bank. It is a densely populated open-air prison with poison water, rationed electricity, and a healthcare system that has been on the brink of collapse since the blockade again. 45% of the people who live in Gaza are under 15 years old, and it is reduced to rubble on a fairly regular basis. Nearly every aspect of Palestinian life in the occupied territories is defined and controlled by the fake regime of Israel's military. Joe Biden and the majority of lawmakers in the U.S. don't want to talk about the occupation or the settlements. They want Palestine to remain in the background. We need to push it back to the foreground. This administration appears to want the region to hold its current trajectory. But it should be clear to everyone at this point that the situation is not only inhumane, but entirely unsustainable. The United States of America is directly supporting a regime administering a widespread ethno-nationalist project punctuated by a brutal military occupation. American money is funding oppression. American money is being used to sustain a system that is a clear violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Activists and NGOs have done everything they can to keep the Palestinian cause alive for decades, from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to offering medical and nutritional relief, fighting for clean water, providing educational opportunities and medical care, and starting youth arts programs. All of those organizations need to continue their support, but they are facing a powerful military backed by an imperial superpower with boundless influence and a military budget larger than the next 10 countries combined. As long as the United States regime continues to offer unconditional support for the fake regime of Israel, the occupation and all its associated abuses will continue. Again, Americans, the taxpaying public of the United States, are funding this. That's why it's imperative for Americans to continue to speak out. This is an issue of human rights. If you care about oppression, justice, and freedom, then you should care about Palestine. And not only when missiles are bombing over the sky on Gaza. Sustained peace in the region means an end to the occupation. This time around, let's not let Palestine fade from the front page. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing US Election Day documentary 11-8-16, produced and created by Jeff Deutschman. And joining me in the studio, we have Anna Smith, who is a film critic and broadcaster. She is also the president of the UK Critics Circle and a regular film critic for various mainstream channels. And beside her, we are also joined by Jonathan Fryer, who is a lecturer, broadcaster and freelance writer. Now, on the 8th of November 2016, Americans from all walks of life went to the ballot box to vote for their next president. Though little did they know at the time what would be in store for them, after most people believed that the country would be seeing its first female president be elected. This documentary, which features the work of many directors and film crews, follows a cross-section of Americans throughout that fateful day and shows the complex and diverse spectrum of opinions about their reasons for voting for Trump or for Clinton, or in some cases, not voting at all.
Days to election, I can update this.
Did you vote today?
I voted early.
You did?
Friday.
Did it feel great?
Today, I'm going to vote for the first time in over 30 years.
Morning, gentlemen. I'm a little nervous about the outcome of the election, future for the coal industry.
You can't stop doing politics. Knock on doors, say, hey, excuse me, did you vote today? Be polite. It's a beautiful day.
The election will be over by 9 o'clock. They'll call it by 9:30, and everything will be peaceful and wonderful.
What if it goes the other way?
What? Not going to go the other way. No way. Mark it down.
Thank you.
I could feel eyes watching me as I walked through that crowd, like they hated me, like I was Donald Trump.
They say, you know, your vote may make a difference, but to me, I don't think so.
हम रहते हैं इस कंट्री में कमा के हम खाना खाते हैं पीछे अपने फैमिली की टेक केयर करते हैं तो आई प्रे अमेरिका लिव लॉन्ग एंड प्रॉस्पर.
It looks like maybe we should be planning for the too close to call scenario or the Trump win.
Out of who we had as president, African Americans were still the lowest man on the totem pole.
There's hope. Never forget that the power of the people is stronger than the people in power.
From sea to shining sea.
First, First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for both of you for coming on. Now, this documentary could be seen as quite a historic and invaluable piece of filmmaking, as it gives the world viewers an insight, a sort of a window into the psyche of Americans voting that day and what they were thinking. And Anna, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you're right that it's an interesting snapshot of Americans, and it also has an emotive subject, a fascinating subject, which all great documentaries need. And what all great documentaries need as well is great characters. And this has lots of really strong characters, people who are voting from different sides, who strongly believe in what they're talking about. And the access to them on a day that is a very important day in their lives means that there's some explosive conversations and some very telling and revealing conversations. So broadly, I liked it.
That's a great opinion. And Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna just said?
Yes, I mean, the technique of the documentary was really interesting. The producers called it a periscope view, with 16 periscopes popping up across all the way from New York over to Hawaii, even interviewing different families and individuals. And of course, it's fascinating because watching it, we know the outcome. But during the film itself, until right at the end, the actual voters are not aware of the outcome. But many of them are really, really engaged, as they either want to Hillary Clinton to win, as what was expected originally, or they're rooting for Trump. And it's fascinating to see how their mood changes, in some cases optimistically, in other ways, for other people, disastrously, as they see exactly what they didn't want to happen and literally are brought to tears.
And the dramatic irony of it actually is what makes the film so fascinating and relevant today to watch, actually. And I just want to talk about Jeff Dutchman's previous work. He made a similar film about Obama's election campaign and his supporters. And I bet we can imagine that probably have had a different tone than compared to this film. What do you think, Anna?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very different, because of course it's fascinating. He goes about these films without knowing the outcome. But obviously people were much more optimistic about Obama winning, and this was a bit of a surprise result in this case. So it's fascinating to think that when he and all the directors involved, he sort of curated this.
And what a feat for filmmaking, actually. I wonder how difficult that must have been to coordinate.
Yeah, he sourced a lot of great filmmakers from all over the world who were very talented. And obviously a lot of them probably had connection with their subjects, which gave rise to some very, very interesting people and subjects. But yeah, I mean, just watching it in retrospect then makes it particularly interesting, of course, because there is this sense of perhaps impending doom or success, depending on your point of view, that you just know is going to be a real shock to some people that you're watching. So it adds to the tension.
It was a great collaborative project indeed. And Jonathan, just quickly before we move on, if you could just take us back to that time, why was it so shocking for Trump to win? And in hindsight, is it actually that surprising?
He was an extraordinary candidate and, of course, has become now a very extraordinary president, because he was absolutely not a normal, run-of-the-mill politician, basically. He was anti-politician. And so it was an enormous shock when he was elected. And everyone did expect, most people expected, Hillary Clinton would win. And I'm sure the director was thinking, right, but it didn't happen.
And it was much to everyone's surprise, actually.
So you are in the vast majority of the populace that does not vote. How are you feeling about that?
I feel pretty good. More than we are voting for any particular candidate, we are voting for the system. And it is a system that I just don't abide by. We don't need new legislation. We don't need a new politician. We don't need the Constitution to change to actually, like, care for our community. You just have to have the will. That's where I put my effort. I put my effort there, because I think change comes from the work that we do, not from the ballot box.
My white people have always had the right to vote, right? Like, my lineage has always been, we've been the power, right? So what would you say to somebody who would be like, wait a minute, you're African American?
You mean like my grandmother?
Yeah, like your grandmother.
As much as I really honor the nothing less than heroics that it took in order for African Americans to be able to vote. You know, getting the right to vote was the equivalent of walking into a room, a game of Monopoly was being played by all rich white men. Game was already in motion, property was already bought, hotels already built, and African Americans earned a right to sit at the table. They earned a right to sit at the table, start in jail, didn't collect $200, start off with no money, no property, nothing. That's a game you cannot win. It's about time that we walk in and wipe the whole damn game off the table and start over.
I think think one of the most prominent issues this documentary exposes is the clear racial division in the US. Thinking back to the scene where we see in Chicago African Americans talking amongst themselves of the conflict they feel in having to choose between Trump or Clinton. And they say that Clinton obviously isn't the great candidate for them either, considering the whole super predator cat scandal and the three strikes you're out sort of thing, and then Trump isn't so great on minorities either. Anna, could you just tell us, did this documentary, was it effective in exposing this racial divide and how complicated this issue is?
I think you're right, it is an extremely complicated issue, and it's very hard in the space of a documentary like this, especially with so many different people and so many different directors, to really get to the heart of the issue. But at the same time, it did touch on a lot of that, and it was very careful, I think, to have a variety of people from different sides and of different races talking about how they felt about it. And I thought the filmmakers succeeded in getting people to be very frank about racial issues, as we saw just there, and very articulate. So it was thought-provoking for me on that level. Mm.
And Jonathan, would you agree? Do you think this documentary exposed
the divided nation? Well, I think it really stressed the diversity rather than the division, the diversity of the American population, people who've been there for generations, some who are very new immigrants. Interesting, it starts with a Sikh taxi driver who is clearly from a Punjabi family who probably very recent immigrants and rather excited by the idea that they will be able to vote. So in that sense, I think it's extremely valuable in showing the different races, ethnicities, religions, etc., that make up the United States. But without a doubt, some people very clearly in the film felt disenfranchised, even if they were able to vote. It's interesting, it ended with a very poor couple in Hawaii living in a tent in a park, who basically sort of say, well, you know, okay, it was election, but what sort of difference is it going to make to our lives? Nothing whatsoever.
And I like how it came actually full circle to that point, actually, that some people are very helpless when it comes to politics and it doesn't make a difference to them. So I just want to talk about some statistics now. Data from the election actually shows that the majority of young white Americans, both male and female, under 44 years old, voted for Hillary Clinton, whereas those mostly over 45 overwhelmingly voted for Trump. So Jonathan, why do you think Americans voted the way they did?
Well, there clearly was a very stark generational divide. It's rather interesting, we had a very similar phenomenon here in Britain in 2016 with a EU referendum in which 45 and over majority voted to leave the EU, 44 and younger voted to stay. So there clearly is something happening between the different generations. But what was really also very interesting about the statistics in the US election was that people outside the cities voted for Trump. It was sort of like a rural revolution of people, particularly older people who maybe had seen their hopes dashed for a brighter future and were therefore determined to go out and to make a protest, basically.
Well, we're lucky to have Jonathan here to give us political context to this. But I was just quickly wondering, Anna, would you have liked for more political context to these stories?
I think it's also well publicised now that even the most casual observer of the news will know exactly what happened on that day and what the results were and what the ramifications would go on to be for the people that we see on camera. I found it interesting as someone that doesn't necessarily follow every inch of political news to find out who, you know, the sort of makeup of the voters and the characters of the voters, because, and particularly the Trump voters, because you hear a lot about and see a lot about Trump himself, but to see who actually voted for him and then giving the reasons why, I found fascinating.
And of course, we actually learned that a lot of people who voted for Trump were scared to admit they voted for Trump, so it was only in the aftermath that we really found what was actually happening. I'm glad we've got to see the sort of behind the scenes of the media rooms and them preparing for the election result. And they largely believed Clinton was going to win. Anna, what could we learn from the documentary about the role media or social media played in the election?
It was fascinating, wasn't it, that they felt that they kind of knew, I mean, they prepared for every scenario, but there was that confidence in the polls, which evidently was misplaced. So I think a lot of journalists could probably learn from that scenario, from watching that. I certainly found it fascinating watching those journalists there sort of hedging their bets, but basically thinking that Hillary was going to win. In terms of the media, in terms of people from all walks of life making assumptions based on what they see and hear. And also when you see people in this documentary watching the results come on screen, on their own TV screens, you just see how sheltered some of those people are on both sides and how little they understand about other people's opinions and how we become, you know, even in social media, we only really follow people with a similar point of view, which isn't, social media is not really explored in this, but I think that's something that's a spring, sort of springboard for thinking about that. Mm,
definitely. It raises many questions, actually. And Jonathan, if I could put that question to you, what role do you think, actually, the media, indeed social media, played on the election?
Well, I think it's two different things, the mainstream media and the social media. The mainstream media, it's clear that most of them, with exceptions such as Fox News, were rooting for Hillary Clinton and firmly expected her to win, though obviously they had to make provision for a result of a different kind. Social media was an entirely different matter because there, the Trumpers, if we can call them that, were really in the ascendant. And this is the first presidential election in the United States where social media had a huge impact. I mean, Donald Trump himself has millions of followers, and whereas many people may say that a lot of what he tweets about on Twitter is rubbish or untrue, it has a huge effect, and he has that great following. And he, of course, despises the mainstream media, talks about fake news, because the liberal commentators on the LA Times and other newspapers, of course, are opposed to the sorts of things that he believes in and propagates.
And why is it that so many people could believe this, though, that he could label the news, certain news channels fake news, and he was so hostile to the press?
Well, we've come into what's called the post-truth world, where it's no longer, you know, what is true that you necessarily accept, but it's what you believe is truth. In other words, if it fits in with your own prejudices and your own approach, then that's fine. That's the news, and that's what you're going to put forward.
And so there's so many interesting questions then that this documentary could raise. Do you think there's any other points and strong themes that this documentary had?
Well, I felt like it could have gone further. It could have shown more Trump supporters, as I said. It could have been more revealing. But in terms of the points it made, for me, characters are such a huge part of it. And to see the dynamic, particularly between one of the husband and wife in Massachusetts, and she's a little bit more reserved about Trump, and he's really gung-ho. And to see the difference between families and couples and generations and how they interpret politics and speak to each other about politics, I thought was really, really interesting.
And that's an interesting point, actually, not to defend Trump supporters, but you realise that they're human beings and not all of them are evil, but they have different motivations and grievances for voting in terms of the whole system and their fight, especially when it comes to finances, I think, in the documentary.
A lot of times I work a long day. I'm out of the house before my kids even get out of bed. And then when I come home, it's 6 o'clock at night, it's dark, you know, it's time to eat dinner and go to bed, basically. So if the economy got better and I was bringing more people and more work into my shop and I could delegate a little bit more, then I'd be able to spend more time with my family. That'd be huge. That would be huge for me. I'm doing okay for myself right now, but it would be even that much better, you know? I don't know. I think if when Hillary gets elected, and I think she's going to get elected because she's going to
cheat.
She's going to cheat. She's going to raise the taxes on everybody, and healthcare right now is crushing us anyway, so I'm concerned that we're going to have a tough time making ends meet.
It's not right, and you know Hillary doesn't care about anything but her pockets.
Take that stupid hat off, man.
I will not take this hat off.
What contribution do you think they made to the documentary?
They brought an entertainment factor, I think, which is really important. There's nothing to say that documentaries about political subjects need to be entirely serious. And it was sort of dark humour, but just seeing the dynamic between them was really involving and entertaining. But it also showed, as I said earlier, that you can, within a couple, see different political views and see different strains and strengths, but also what worrying things that people might be influencing each other and perhaps voting is what they don't personally actually really believe in. They're being swayed.
Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna said?
Yeah, they were a fascinating family, and they raised two issues there in that which are really important. You know, there's tax, because Trump was saying he's going to cut taxes particularly for the higher income earners, which would be attractive to business people. And the other thing was Obamacare. You know, one of the huge things that really figured in the election was the cost of Obamacare. President Obama brought in a system where poor people had medical insurance.
Surely that's a good thing.
Great.
Isn't that akin to the NHS?
But the Trumpers, on the other hand, were saying we're paying for all these people to do that. But very interesting point made by a number of people. during the film is they were voting against someone rather than for someone. And that's why Hillary lost, even though, of course, she actually got more votes than Trump did in the popular vote.
About 2.9%.
But she was more unpopular than Trump was.
And does that expose flaws, then, I suppose, in the American voting system?
Well, to us in Britain, which we don't have a flawless system here either, but it does seem really weird that someone can win the popular vote but lose the presidency.
Mm. And indeed, and I just wanted to talk about the parallels, actually, between the UK and the US and theatrical aspect of the US. I was just wondering, is there a documentary of this sort that would be as fascinating in the UK as it would be to follow an American election? Do you think it would be as interesting?
Well, obviously, Brexit docs are fascinating, aren't they? I mean, that's the closest thing we've had recently. You're right, though. The Americans do have a showy way about them. But goodness, look at reality TV shows in the UK. We've certainly got our fair share of big personalities. So I think good documentaries can always find them.
Yes. Oh, no, that's a good point, actually, indeed, as also that we can compare. And I suppose UK politics seems to be a bit more on the serious side, or perhaps not.
Well, it'd be very interesting. The next election, presumably, we will have Jeremy Corbyn leading the Labour Party into an election campaign, and there'll be a big focus on, is this a man who can be Prime Minister? Is this a man who can lead Labour Party to victory? Because the opinion polls at the moment are saying more or less the Conservatives and Labour equal pegging, which is bizarre when the government is doing things which are frankly difficult to support. Why isn't the opposition miles ahead? So there's a ground for a real mystery there. So perhaps some documentary maker could already be plotting the election coverage documentary of Election Day, whenever it's going to be.
Perhaps. And just going back to the documentary, as we near the end of this discussion now, actually, I just wanted to get, Anna, your final thoughts on this documentary, and also would you recommend it?
I don't think it's an earth-shattering documentary, but I think it's very, very interesting. And I think if you want a further insight into what motivated a lot of American people to place their vote a certain way, then it's well worth a watch.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, if I turn to you, your final thoughts on the film?
Yeah,
would you
when
recommend
it first started, I thought, oh my goodness, we're going to watch this for an hour and 45 minutes. Am I going to really be interested? But you do get interested in the characters, in the individual families. In fact, I was disappointed when it finished.
Mm-hmm. And we'll have to leave it there on that good note to end it on. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.